listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another Catch Them Doing Something Good edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. Each week, my guests and I will bring you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. I'm thrilled to have as our guest today, Greg Hartley. Greg's expertise as an interrogator first earned him honors with the United States Army. More recently, Greg has served as an advisor with national-level intelligence organizations, and served as a business consultant to Fortune 500 companies in the U.S. as well as international clients. Greg teaches and consults the use of extreme interpersonal skills in a daily business applications. Among his numerous books are How to Spot a Liar, I Can Read You Like a Book, The Date Decoder, and his latest publication, The Body Language Handbook. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
Hey, I'm glad to have you here, and I got to tell you, as an investigator myself, who has been deceived on an occasion or two, I think my first question is, where did these skills come from?
Well, I started off my career in the U.S. Army, and when people read that, sometimes they're put off because they hear the word interrogator, but I started off my career in the U.S. Army as I was working in infantry battalions, and I was given the opportunity to go to language school. And I went to Monterey, to Defense Language Institute, to learn Arabic. And, of course, the Army wants you to pay bills with whatever they teach you. So I had to choose between being an interrogator or being a voice interceptor or a listener. So I went off to interrogation school, then began to teach resistance. Went off to the first Gulf War, spent some time there, came back and taught interrogation, resistance, and body language for the next few years before I left in 2000 to start business.
Well, now, I mean, interrogation, I mean, for the most part, it's communication. So how do you define communication?
Well, yeah, and when we think about communication, think about what people are trying to say to you and what they're actually saying. So most people will choose their words. Their brain is absolutely in control of their choice of words and how they're pronounced. And I call that the verbal piece, and that's just simply diction. So where I live in the Southeast, there's a very different speech pattern, cadence, choice of words than there would be in LA. And that piece is the verbal piece. Then the next two pieces are the part that are a little bit more complicated. There's the vocal, and the vocal is relaxing or tensing the vocal cords, listening to tone, listening to all those things we recognize as parents or as children, because we've all heard from our mothers, it's not what you said, it's how you said it. So how stress impacts the vocal cords so that you're struggling with the body and the mind trying to control the vocal cords. And then the last part is that everyone's interested in now from TV and movies and all that, and that's the nonverbal piece, the piece that is body language, the piece that's communicating with our bodies what our intent is, as well as accidentally communicating something we don't intend to communicate.
Well, I mean, share with us kind of what percentage is what, and I know that there's some of the things that I've learned as well, but how much of what people are saying, you know, is true from the standpoint of verbal, and how are you picking up some of those things based on the body language?
Well, it's interesting because there are tons of studies that say 85% of communication is nonverbal, and by nonverbal they mean the vocal cords tightening as a result of fight or flight, stress, or those kinds of things, or the punctuation. When we're thinking, when we're speaking, our hands, even as I speak to you on the radio, my hands are gesturing. I'm punctuating my thoughts with my hands as we speak. So what we look for, much like a polygrapher, is we establish a baseline, look for normal for that person, get them to talk about something that's relaxed, something they're comfortable with. And then as we start into an area of stress, whether it's a child, an adult, a criminal, an everyday person, as we feel stress, our body starts to leak information, whether it's because of vocal cords tightening, our gesturing patterns changing, movement of our hands going away from in front of us off to the side. There are tremendous number of things to indicate deception.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned a little bit about fight or flight. Why is that so important?
Well, I think when you think about everyday people, we all go through life assuming that we're in absolute control of our bodies and our minds. But if you have children, if you've been around children, you know they ramp up much quicker. The older we get, the less quickly we ramp up. But when fight or flight hits you, it does a few things. First of all, the things that you can see from outside, the things like the skin going pale as blood leaves the skin and the reproductive and digestive systems to go to muscles, it ramps up your respiration. It changes everything about a person's normal baseline. What it in effect does is turns off the ability to think, and it turns on the ability to react. Much interrogation, when you talk about interrogation and the communication piece of it, most of it's around that. Most of it's about getting a person to react so they say something without thinking. And it's not about at all intimidation or the coercion or those things that we're looking at in the media today. What we find is wherever a person is when they walk into that room, and you imagine they're in a higher level of fight or flight when they're being interrogated for a crime or whatever, an investigation, but you can still see that baseline deviate as you get to the issues. And in your life as an investigator, as you walk up to the edge of the issue, even if the person was highly stressed before you got to the issue, you could still see that escalation. And the hormones change the way our body responds, the way our vocal cords tighten, the way our hands and bodies move and smoothly transition from one gesture to the next. They get more jerky. Your hands get more edgy. You see adapters and illustrators change. Pieces of body language that we use as standard terminology, you start to see those things deviate and shift. So fight or flight, you have to understand where the person's at in the cycle and then look for deviation.
And I would guess that when you hear speakers, like, for instance, just, you know, a professional speaker speak, you're probably hearing some things that other people aren't. And I know even I just came back from a week-long retreat, and there was a lot of professional speakers, but yet I could tell in certain instances they were mixing in some people who were not necessarily professional speakers. And afterwards, they would come down, and I happened to be in a circle with a group of them, and they went, oh, that was great. That was wonderful. You really knocked it out. You did a great job. And the person said, well, actually, I was really kind of nervous. Couldn't you tell? And just about everybody in the circle said, no, I couldn't tell at all. And I didn't say anything, but I sat back, and I thought, well, I could absolutely tell the change in your voice. You know, so what you're saying is that, you know, it is something that's out there, but it's a learned skill. How is it that you've gotten to the point that you've honed the skills, and how can other people hone these skills as well?
Well, great question. The first thing I try to tell people all the time is I'm no better at this. I was no better at this when I started than anyone else. And the main advantage I have over most people is that I can put words to what I'm seeing. You all recognize that you all see it. It's a matter of giving yourself permission. We live in a culture that expertise is everything, and we start to defer to people who are experts. And if you watch it, you'll see yourself deferring to people for no reason other than someone told you they're an expert. Mm-hmm. So I would say the first step is opening your eyes, seeing what you're or looking at what you're seeing, opening your mind and giving yourself permission to read what you're noticing. Parents are very good at reading their children. A lot of times they have that gut instinct, as they refer to it, that something's wrong, but they will not give themselves permission to act on that. The same thing's true in almost every part of our life. When you hear about a serial killer and a person says, I always knew there was something odd, but he seemed so normal, they're right. Covering up that natural instinct to see that something's wrong, you know, to have that eye, to look. And humans are built more than any other creature on the planet to communicate. So the first step is just opening your eyes. The second is getting to a common understanding of language so you can start to put anchor points and some concrete concepts together as you're trying to analyze. Because if all you can do is say, I feel like, but you can't anchor that to a fact like a change in gesture, a change in voice tone, a change in cadence, all of those things, you have to get to a commonality of language, some way to anchor these things in your head that you can move forward.
Okay, well, how can...
And there's some...
go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, there's some accepted across the industry concepts to anchor all of these ideas and to talk about them. And, you know, I'm a big Jungian psychology fan. At the same time, I often try to remind people that anytime you're putting labels to a personality, it's so that you can catalog and you can have a way to understand and talk about people in your head. Same thing's true with these body language concepts.
Okay, now, how can, and as you were saying that, I was thinking, okay, you recognize that something is wrong. In other words, you see you know, you see the way that the eye looks, or that the way that the vocal cords tighten or something. How do you then get to that next point? So in other words, and let's take it not necessarily from an interrogation, but just, you know, in a relationship, you know, it's, you know, a spouse or your teenager. Now, you know that something's wrong, but you don't know what at that point.
And the first step, I would say, is to be careful about projection, which is the human nature. We naturally project what we believe.
Right.
But once you get to the point you can do that and you can turn on tools, I often say to people, I don't walk around every day of my life analyzing everyone I deal with. Mm-hmm. That would be insanity.
Oh, yeah.
But I do exactly what you just said. When I think there's something wrong, I bring up the tool set. So, for instance, you learn to baseline eye movement with people. We use it in the interrogation room, you can use it in job interviews, you can use it in daily life, you can use it on your teenager. You know a lot of control questions, a lot of information about that person's daily life. So if you ask a question that's non-intrusive, that's part of everyday conversation, and it forces the person to recall information, their eyes will go to a certain portion of their head. And you can baseline eye movement for auditory memory, baseline eye movement for visual memory, baseline eye movement for calculation. And then when you see it deviate from memory when you're asking a memory question, you get a pretty good indicator. I'll give you an example.
Okay.
If you answer this question as you're listening to this radio show and pay attention to your own eyes, with 90% likelihood, your eyes are going to drift slightly up and to your left, meaning above your brow, your cheekbone, but below your brow ridge. And the question, a contrived one, is what is the fifth word of the Star-Spangled Banner? You catch your eyes?
It's C.
It is C.
Yeah.
And what you're doing is you're recalling an auditory stimulus from somewhere in your past. If you sit later and try to recall poetry, any song lyric, or any conversation you've had, you'll find that your eyes drift to a given portion of your head. In 90% of the population, we find their eyes drift to the left. And for auditory, it typically drifts slightly above the cheekbone toward the temporal lobe of the brain. Same thing's true with the visual side. If I ask you for directions to the nearest Wendy's from where you're sitting with some visual landmarks, and you have to come up with visual landmarks, you'll look higher in your head but to the same direction you went for recall for sound. So if I know that, and I ask questions, not as contrived, but a casual conversation about, you know, last week we were sitting with John, he was talking about Sue, and he said that she had boom. Then you get the person engaged in conversation, they recall what they heard, and you baseline them. It's a pretty useful tool in business. I use it every day in the business world.
Yeah, I like
that. So then when I ask a question that means that the person should be recalling and they deviate from that pattern, I have reason to be suspicious they're creating new detail.
Gotcha. Now, are there any absolutes in this area?
You know, the only real absolute, there are very few, and part of that has to do with culture and everything else, but the only real absolute that comes to mind immediately is the eyebrow flash. When you recognize someone that you have seen before, that you know, your brows instantly rise and drop. And I'm not talking about holding up your brows as you talk, but it's just a really sudden flash of the brow and a drop. And we know that's true. You've been to parties where you recognize someone and they say they recognize you, but it just doesn't seem right. What I believe that is on a subconscious level, they did not raise their brow. And you, on a subconscious level, know that. You instinctively get it, and you know they did not know you. So as an experiment, when you're sitting in a mall, when you're sitting in a public area, if you'll quickly flash your brow as someone walks by, you can watch them start rifling through their head for where they know you from. No idea why, they just get it.
Now, you mentioned a little bit about culture, but, I mean, what impact does culture have on body language?
Well, if you think about everything we do as human beings, there's a given range of movements that you can do with your body. I mean, whether it's, you know, raising your fingers in the air one at a time, or it's tapping on the table. As culture evolves, each of those things starts to take on either some kind of a taboo to curtail it from being used, or it might take on social significance. In the book, The Body Language Handbook, we talk to two people. One of them would casually relax with his hands on top of his head, for example, and that's just his relaxed posture. And then I was talking to another young man from Ghana, who told me that means, when you're talking about a person, that they're deceased. So that's a curtailing of natural posture. If the guy who was an Anglo from the U.S. were to go to Ghana, put his hands on his head and start talking about a person, the perception immediately would be the person he's talking about is dead.
Wow.
So if you think about culture, like the use of the left hand in the Middle East, or waving a middle finger or thumb or any of those things, culture assigns significance to a given gesture or a given piece of body language, and therefore limits it from meaning anything else and prevents its use for anything else.
Hmm. That's interesting. Yeah, and as you were saying that, I was thinking about the thing, I think I think it's Japan, but I mean where, you know, if you show the bottoms of your feet, you know, to someone, if you were to raise up, and as some people will raise up and cross their legs in a meeting, and allow your foot to be up, that apparently is an insult.
Same in the Middle East, you would never show the soles of your feet to anyone.
Yes.
And you would never touch them with your left hand or gesture with your left hand. It's just part of the culture.
Right, right. Now, let's talk a little bit about the book. I was able to read through a little bit of it, but interestingly enough, I have a 15-year-old son who's been helping me with some of the books, and I'm allowing him to sort of pick and choose which ones, and then if he has questions, he gives them to me. He picked your book out instantly, and he's been reading it, didn't want to give it back to me.
Well, that's good.
and didn't have any questions that he wanted me to ask. He said, "No, Dad, I just want to read it." So
you're in trouble, yeah.
Yeah, but I think because he's 15, I think it's also at that age in which you want to know what girls are thinking and things like that.
Right.
But you know, so tell me a little bit about kind of what your hope is for somebody reading this book, be them 15 or 50.
Well, the whole idea behind anything we've written is, and I have a co-author, Marianne Karench, who is the writer side of the business. I had to have someone write off who was an agent who knew how to do this, so it becomes a much easier process for me. And now that we've done six together, it's become much more comfortable. Both of us do a little bit of the writing, and she's starting to learn all this. But the idea that I'm after is that anything that I know that can help people, I'd like to share that. I also don't want people to think that when I say, I did this and I did that, I'm trying to give you examples of how it worked for me, that that's what you need to do. Every person has their own skill set, their own frame of reference that they can bring to these tools, and they're going to see how to use them differently. They're going to take whatever it is that I know and make it more powerful in their lives. The more exposure they've had to different kinds of people, the more life experiences, the more polished they'll become at this. So what I hope is that what I'm doing here will give someone a new set of tools, a new skill set that they can use in their life, and hoping that as they read through my books, and we talk about interrogation, that's not off-putting to them, but just my frame of reference for how I learn the skill sets.
Right. Well, and you mentioned a little bit about how, you know, when you talk about your experience, and you kind of suggested that it's all that not that important, I tend to disagree. I think it's very important because I think that's what we need. I mean, as humans, we want to see something that's modeled to know that it works. Wow. All of a sudden, we just had a weird sound that just... Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. So let me ask. I mean, you know, having a little technical...
I heard that, too. But I can hear you.
Okay, good. But, I mean, as an ex-Army interrogator, I mean, tell us a little bit about your life and the experiences using this, you know, not only in the military, but even since you were leaving, because I think that that's important for people to understand that, you know, you can use this in those types of situations, and that's allowed you to hone the skills and then carry it over to something that's new. As you're saying, I noticed in going to the website is that, you know, you're using it now, you know, for businesses that are using it in sales and in different things, to where this is something that'll help you, you know, that'll help people. In other words, by reading the book, you may be thinking, oh, you know what, I'm not really that concerned. Everything's happy in my relationship and people are doing fine. And when I'm buying a car, I don't care if they're lying to me. But even from the standpoint of other types of interactions that you have with people, just a little bit of this knowledge may help you to make a better decision.
Yeah, The one thing I would tell you, when we talk about interrogation, I often say interrogation is about nothing more than getting the most information out of the shortest period of time. So if you're interviewing someone for a job, it's helpful. If you are doing discovery for a legal case, if you are doing, I actually have done some work with attorneys, whatever you're doing in your daily life, this is about making you more effective and more efficient. While in my past life in interrogation, it was more about getting the information, having veracity, remembering that police interrogation often is about confession. Military interrogation is about actual fact because it's targeting information. It's information to rescue hostages. It's information that's key to the action. So in the military side, it teaches you to be very decisive, to have personal courage, to stand in front of people and make decisions that might turn out badly. I think, if anything, that gave me an edge getting into business because nothing I do in the business world, nothing I've done in my business career has been life and death. It can be in the military side.
Right.
So it gave me courage that it worked there and that what we were getting was real. And I will tell you, 10 years after I left the military, there are kids out there today doing things that would probably make me look like nothing because they've been interrogating day in, day out for the past 10 years, right, since the beginning of the wars. So if you can take the value that comes from something like interrogation, the understanding how to hold an effective meeting. And I'll run through a list of things I teach people. How to hold an effective meeting with desired outcomes, a tight agenda, and a closeout with a loop back to ensure that you've met all of your goals. How to read the person you're talking to know if they're getting emotional versus answering truthfully and fact and with fact. How to deal with conflict, how to de-escalate a conflict. How to tell if someone is hedging when you're in a conversation about money. For instance, if you're in a sales side of a business and someone has a hedge and they're hedging their percentage of money they've put aside for contingency on a project, those kinds of things, all of that's visible and easy to figure out when you're talking to someone. Add to that, you use some in the morning you go to work.
All right. On that last bit, we had another little technical difficulty, so I'm not sure if everybody got it. But I know that one of the thoughts that I had as you were saying that is that how important is this is in regards to motivation?
Yeah, you know, for me, when I think about people's motivation, some folks will tell me I'm jaundiced, but I'll tell you, no one gets out of bed in the morning and goes to work for a reason other than something personal, whether that is achievement in that group or achievement in some other peer group. If you think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs from the 1940s, he said that, you know, there are five tiers. At the base are your physiological needs. Next were your safety needs, then your belonging needs, then your esteem needs, and then finally self-actualization. I always say the only thing you're dealing with when you're talking about motivation for people is that belonging and esteem needs. So within any given group, we join, we get to the point we belong and feel comfortable, and we immediately start to differentiate. We start to show how we're better than that group at something. Even if it's politely and humbly, it's important to us that we show within a given peer group how good we are at something.
All right.
If you think about that, think about daily life and what makes people get out of bed and go to work, that's it. And then as they get past a certain level within that peer group and they start to become a big fish in a little pond, they'll either stay a big fish in a little pond and stagnate, or they'll move to become a small fish in a bigger pond and start to differentiate over again. So it's a constant process, and it's human behavior at its best.
All right. All right. We are talking with Greg Hartley. We're going to take a break. Now, Greg, if anybody wants to follow along, because of the fact that we are over the Internet, what is the website they can go to and sort of be looking at some of the things we're talking about?
You could go to www.greghartley.com.
All right. So if you'd like, while we're in the break, go to that website, take a look, look around, see what the books are that are available, and we will be right back in 1 minute. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more.
Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success.
Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
All right, we're back with Greg Hartley, and we are talking about being able to determine if somebody is telling you the truth. We have some listener questions that I would like to share, and let me see if I can read them. We've got some that were emailed in, and our first one says, our listener had a question about your topic, protecting yourself from manipulation. The question is, it seems that teens are getting more sophisticated all the time in their ability to manipulate each other, and it says, parentheses, peer pressure, and in manipulating their parents. What are your thoughts on this? And then there's another question. It says, what can we as parents do to teach our children to protect themselves and at the same time keep them from manipulating us?
Well, I'll answer the last one first and then go back to the first. In order to protect yourself from manipulation by your children, you have to stop projecting. It's our nature with children to want to believe our children are perfect or that they're not perfect, whichever direction it is. I watch parents all the time who want to believe the best in their children and let them get away with things, and then those of us who are more critical. And I think we have to learn not to project, to open our eyes and to look at a child, remembering that when a child is in puberty especially, their frontal lobe is not functioning normally. And it's just a fact that they're fluctuating back and forth because of wild hormone fluctuations. And they're going to have all kinds of glitchy body language that you will not have in your 40s, in your 30s. So open your eyes and look for what's normal for the child and look for deviation. You know it. You don't want to accept it sometimes. But I think it's the most difficult thing for us as human beings is not to project. We project what we want to see, whether it's good or bad. That's the first, so you will not be manipulated. The second piece, and this is a lot harder because you're not cool. Your kids are part of a peer group that most of them do not think of their parents as cool or part of that crowd, part of that in crowd. Right. And even a very enlightened child who does see his parents as out for his own, for his good, when he's with that peer group, is going to have a difficult time. Remember what we were just talking about is motivation, that belonging and differentiating are the two most primary drives in a person at that age. And like you said about a 15-year-old son, he's interested in what young women are thinking, what girls are thinking.
Right.
That's a driver for them. The first thing is they're trying to bond and become more like adults. They're going through a lot on a daily basis, but they're in that group. They're in that peer group. You hope that they're in the right peer group. And they have to differentiate and show that they're better, stronger, smarter, prettier, faster, all of that so that they can rise to a position of what I refer to as super typical, the people who are emulated by the rest of the group.
Okay. Now, we've got another question, again, emailed in. It says, it happens to be a 15-year-old. This is not mine, but my 15-year-old teenager seems to have lost interest in school or anything outside his video games and hanging out with his friends. My husband thinks this is normal, but I am worried that my son will not make the grades to get into college. It says, you mentioned developing skills to get people to do what you want, what you want them to do. Does this technique apply more to people outside your family, or can it work with kids and husbands as well?
It can. It absolutely can. Remember, I often say to women when they ask questions about who makes a great interrogator, who makes a great this or that, women's brains are much better developed for right-left brain function than men's, so we're much easier to manipulate than women are by any stretch. But the piece I would say is important is remembering that peer group is all important. You cannot put enough pressure on a child from your angle to make them feel like doing something as easily as you can make them feel more like doing it because their peer group sees it as valuable. And I'll give you an example. There are online games today where people continually get levels. They feel like they can belong. They can interact with other people. They've never met these people. They could be 60-year-old men they're playing video games with, and they think they're cool 14-year-olds. And they continually are trying to get that elevation to that next level, that constant growth. And the people who market those video games are genius at making it always anticlimactic, and you got to go to the next level. That's the danger in life, is exactly what the video game is doing, is the person constantly striving to get there and then feeling no sense of fulfillment and needing to go to the next step. So if you can see that and get them to understand that outside of video games, there are other things that bring that same fulfillment, that's your best opportunity.
Oh, that's a great point that you bring up, and I've not heard it presented quite that way, but I like that. Okay, we have another question, another listener question. It says, the economy has been very hard on business in general. How could mastering body language help me improve my company's sales efforts and give me an edge over my competitors?
Well, I'll tell you that sitting face-to-face with a customer, and I teach salespeople this all the time, and understanding what the person's drives are, why, what they're looking for, sensing pain points, and any salesperson will know that. If you can solve the person's pain, if you can find the solution to their problems, you win. Because people don't buy product, they buy relationships typically. Unless your product is just head and shoulders above the rest of the crowd, they're buying that relationship. So we teach typically how to recognize a pain point, those down to the right eye movements, how to recognize calculation, how to read the words the person's not using versus the words they are using, so that they start to trust you and see you as an advisor more than someone trying to sell them something.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I would imagine this works quite well also in hiring practices.
Absolutely. I've done some work with HR. As a matter of fact, a few weeks ago, I taught an HR workshop around interviewing. And there's so many different interviewing processes out there, from targeted selection to all the others that go at it with a certain angle. Often, if you can get away from thinking about what you want to ask and start going toward the angle of what is it that I want to know, instead of questioning, follow the conversation. I teach people to do, in the interrogation world, we have interrogations that start off without knowing anything about the person, and we follow their conversation. And I try to teach that for HR, so that you're following the person's conversation to find out how quick they are at adapting to stress, how quickly they can grasp concepts, instead of letting them tell you how great they were at their last job.
All right, that sounds great. And I know that that's a huge thing right now in regards to just in hiring practices in general in this day and age. So I think that makes a lot of sense. Let me jump to one more listener question we've got. And this one says, if I read something in my child where I think that they're lying and question him about it, how do I pose the question without calling him a liar?
You know, children usually are pretty adept at knowing when they're lying and they're busted, and you don't have to call them. Anytime in my life, even if I were to tell a lie, as a young kid all the way through now, and someone calls you on it, you don't have to call them a liar. All you have to do is verify the facts. And typically people lie in three fashions. They either omit facts, they plain truth, or they plain cloth lie, what I call omission or commission, and the last is a transfer or embellishment lie. You know, the fish was 12 inches long when it was 6, or I'm transferring stories from something I saw on TV or in a video game. There are different ways to break each. If a person left out something and you go backward through the story, you know, they say, I went to school and then I went home, and you back them up from home, what time did you get home, how long did it take you to drive from school, and you go backward, they're busted, because no one practices a lie backwards. And those kinds of ways, those tools to get through the lie without calling them a liar are usually more productive anyway. They usually give up and tell you.
On a more personal note, do you run into any problems turning it off, and from the standpoint of yourself, turning it off so that it doesn't drive you crazy?
I'm pretty good at that. I have a wonderful woman in my life I've been with for 10 years, and I can't tell you what her eyes do when she's telling the truth. And I think if you can't turn it off, it will drive you crazy. And I remember when I was 20-something and first started learning this, it was always on.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to learn, like every other skill set you have, you don't take everything from work home every day. And it's just something you use when you feel like you can't trust someone. I say to people all the time, I'm a very auditory creature. And when I hear something that sounds out of the norm, I turn on all the visual cues and start looking at the person and analyzing. But until then, if I have no reason, I just carry on my conversation as if everyone's telling me the truth.
Good, good. Yeah, I've sort of dealt with some of the same things, so I understand it completely. Now, and again, having gone through the book a little bit, I know that the book deals with how to send the right message. Can you give our listeners an example of this in regards to sending the right message?
Yeah, I think when we think about body language, there are a few pieces. There is something called an adapter. An adapter is simply stroking your ear, your hair, picking at your nails, anything that releases nervous energy. When you're in a job interview, when you're trying to be believed, you need to be cautious with releasing nervous energy in that way. So, for example, if I'm trying to send a positive message, but I'm digging at my nails, picking at my hair, twirling my hair, rubbing my arms or my thighs, I'm sending the wrong message. Learn to curl your toes and your shoes so you're sending a message of confidence and relaxation and that what you're saying is fact. And because remembering that what you learn from a book like this will give you an edge on reading what someone's really thinking, you also have to realize that they've been taught all their lives that crossing your arms means you're locking someone out. So you have to remember those misconceptions when you're talking to someone, because perception's reality. So you have to keep your arms open. And so that's adapters. Illustrators, I use my hands to punctuate what I'm thinking. Ensure those are in line with what you're thinking. Even when you're feeling stress, slow down, use your hands to illustrate your points, punctuate on the note, and don't beat someone over the head with a stick, so to speak. And you watch every president in the history of the U.S. has whipped you across the head with his fingers. He's driving home points you need to remember. We don't take well to that. So you want that so you're perceived correctly when you're illustrating. Then there's another one that's called a barrier, and that's about putting something between me and you to give me more space. It can be figurative, something as simple as a bottle holding it between us as I'm talking to you, all the way up through using a big mahogany desk to protect myself from everyone. So realizing the more open you are, the more people trust you, you want to keep your hands unfolded away from your torso. You typically want to keep your elbows away from your torso because people instinctively know that that means you're uncomfortable. And you want to send a positive message at every opportunity.
Okay. Now, what about the smaller things? And I like the fact what you said is if somebody has that energy, you know, curl your toes inside your shoes so that they can't see it. But I know that when I'm watching some of the people, and interviewing is one of the things, is, you know, watching them, you know, rubbing their hands or picking at their fingernails, you know, and they're picking at it and picking at it and stuff, where I'm feeling like if I wasn't there, they'd be biting them, you know, but that they think that they're doing something a little bit less by only picking at them. And you're right. And then my thought is that, you know, they're obviously very nervous about this. How do I then take that and go, And I try to do things to set them at ease. I mean, that's just me. But right. I'm also trying to read from that, how is this person going to deal with some of the stressful situations that come up in our business in when they're dealing with, like they're dealing with an at-risk youth or something like that? Are they going to be able to deal with that? And is this just something that happens because it's their first time sitting before the boss of the company?
Right. And I think what you have to do is probe. You have to give them a little pressure and release to know that. Some people are just, remember we talked about baseline and fight or flight. Some people have baselines, their normal body language is glitchy, picky, constantly tweaking something, tapping their fingers, especially if you're dealing with a 20-something male. It's just the nature of who we are in that age group. We have to polish that away. So you have to look for what's normal. And maybe the person is just always on, always tweaking and twitching and that kind of thing. And if that's detrimental to the business, you probably don't want that. But it might just be their way of feeling comfortable. Then the other thing is looking for deviation, because if that person came in and you started to push on them and you noticed their fight or flight rising very simply, it tells you whether they can deal with stress or not. And that fight or flight piece, that the outward symptoms of it are pretty easy to see. The skin goes pale, the lips get thin, pupils dilate to take in more of the threat, respiration rises, nostrils flare. If you start to see that in an interview, you probably are dealing with a person who's not going to deal with that stress very well. And that kind of stress shouldn't come from talking to the new boss for the first time.
Yeah, I was going to say, what you were describing sounded like more than stress. It sounded like anger.
But that's the interesting piece of humans, is we have adapted over however many generations from our families to be the kind of beings that can't tell the difference. When we're angry, mm-hmm. we prepare for fight. When we're terrified, we prepare to fight or to flee. So all of the same mechanisms are going into place. The difference, the one key difference you can tell, is when a person is very pale-faced, mm-hmm. their frontal lobe is turning off. When a person is red in the face and they're angry, they at least still have some presence. The most dangerous person you ever deal with is the lily-white-faced person with thin lips, because they're past thinking at that point.
Wow. Very good to know. Wow, man, I got to tell you, this is all really good stuff. I know that, I go into the website and I looked and you had some of the other books. Another one of your very popular books is How to Spot a Liar. If someone is a really, really good liar, I mean, you have somebody who is very, very astute at this. How do you spot that? I mean, are there things that you have to look for the person that's almost the professional liar?
Yeah, there are things, and of course you look for their normal. Remembering that psychopaths typically have no conscience and no remorse for doing things to you, they might still be stressed about being caught, and that's the thing you have to remember. The more they've practiced, the more old hat it is to them, the more commonplace it becomes. Remembering that we said there are three kinds of lying: commission, omission, and transference or embellishment. If you're saying someone commits a lie, the thing I've discovered in interrogating prisoners, when people lie, they make up snapshots. They rarely make up the whole photo album, and they don't have enough details for you to be able to support their story. It's why cover stories don't work, for example, when you're doing intelligence gathering and you're living in a foreign country. You have to live something. You have to know the details. The same thing is true with soldiers. Every time I would get a young soldier in going through resistance to interrogation, where they're learning what to do if they're captured, they would make up a little snapshot in time and not have enough details to support the story. It falls apart all the time. So that's commission. Omission. And much smarter people than I am have come up with something called verbal bridging. It's a person leaves a store, they say they go to the store, and let's say they stole something and walked out. They say, I went in, I looked around, and then I left. Well, that and then is an indicator that you need to talk to them. And lies of commission, the details break them. In lies of omission, the lack of follow-through breaks them. So if you think about a forward pass at the lie and a backward pass at the lie, you don't have to be an interrogator to do it. You can do it casually, like I was saying about your child. And so what time did you leave the school? If you ask them, let's say 2:15, what time did you get home? 4:30. Well, there's a gap. But if you go backward pass and you say, hey, what time did you get home today? 4:30. Really, what happened between the time you left school and there? Now you've opened the door for a conversation. Most of us have a tendency to get away with what we will when we lie, including the professional liar. They'll hop right over the subject, and as soon as they do, often you can recognize a shift in cadence of their voice as they are happy to get past that and start talking about something else.
Okay, go ahead.
Then embellishment, you simply have to follow through. It's the hardest to break. You just have to follow through the details and see if they're genuinely their details or something they've memorized, and eye movement helps with that.
Right, and what about dealing with the liar that then takes the offensive at that point, you know, where they try to turn it around to the point of, instead of answering the question, it becomes, I can't believe you're asking me this. What is wrong with you that you feel that you have to ask me where it was that, you know, and you have this instant switch to where they're trying to, you know, to sidestep the question by taking an offensive approach.
Yeah, and typically in my past life, even whether it's business or it's in the intelligence business, when someone goes on the assault, that's usually your best indicator. I sidestep and let them overexert and wait for an opening. And then I use their own words, something in my old business we would call a source lead. I listen for words that are out of place, and I look for where the deviation is occurring when they're, because typically they're going to have to justify why it is they're going at you. They typically don't just assault. They also assault with information, carefully chosen information about the situation, and I listen for leads in that and follow through. The other thing is when you get to that kind of conflict and the person's ramped up, they're not thinking. If you don't see all of the body language that I was talking about for fight or flight, then it's not real. And if they're just ranting, if you'll listen to them and nod, they'll continue to talk. People that continue to talk have a tendency to leave gaps and openings for you to ask questions later.
Okay, and then taking that now in a family relationship situation, how do you get them back to the subject without severely damaging the relationship it is? So again, if you're dealing with your spouse, your teenager, or whatever, to still get back, because they can tend to take it away. Now we've gotten so far away from the subject matter that we haven't figured out what happened between 2:15 and 4:30, but we are finding out that they think that you're whatever it is that they think based on your questions.
Yeah, I think in that case, what you have to do is bring it back to the grounding, why you ask the question in the first place. And a lot of that's going to have to do with your past relationship, right? If you've got a really rough relationship already, it's going to be harder to bring back. But in the situation where you ask questions, and I have a stepson, and I went through this very thing with him where I would address and say, bam, 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 why'd you do this? And in particular, it was around, in my situation, feeding horses. Horses are not forgiving. They need to be fed on 12-hour intervals. And so, I mean, someone's trying to beep into my phone.
Oh, okay.
One second, I'll go back to this.
All right.
So, my stepson told me, yes, I fed the horses. And I go over, nothing's changed. All I had to do was, and it was obvious that I was ramping up the same time he would ramp. I simply backed up and said, let's look at the facts, and you'll see where I'm coming from. Now, realizing that someone who has issues with the way you're dealing with them is going to have a very different approach, and they're going to just simply lash out. There comes sometimes you have to push the topic off because you're both at a point of escalation, and neither of you can think. If you're both reacting and neither of you are thinking, it's going to go nowhere. You're simply going to cause long-term damage to the relationship, and you're not going to be able to ever do that same thing again because you'll have trigger points. You'll have rituals of escalation that you can't break.
Okay, and then...
Is that helpful? Am I answering?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, yeah. No, I mean, that makes perfect sense, and that's one of the things that I know that I get, you know, we've had in calls, we've had in emails and stuff, saying, I believe that my child is doing this. I believe that my child is on drugs, or I believe, you know, and we've said, well, drug test them, you know. But, you know, it's,
right.
You know, I believe that this has happened. But when I confront them with it, everything gets turned around to the point that they never really get resolution to that problem because they've now created three others and the relationship's getting further and further eroded, and they still never got their answer. So this is sort of a... You know, it's a psychological issue, but there's also some of the things that I think if we can read that ahead of time, maybe we can keep from taking those steps first.
Yeah, and I'll tell you the first easy one to pick up. When someone's heading toward emotion, stress, first of all, will cause your pupils to flash, you know, to broaden and then narrow back. But more importantly, as a person's eyes drift down to the right, they're moving into an emotional quadrant of their brain. They're starting to get emotional. Stop. Pushing them there is not going to do you any good. In an interrogation, I might do that to cause a person to react instead of think.
Right.
But your family is not an interrogation experience,
right.
And you need to maintain stability there.
Yes, yeah, maintain the relationship.
That's right. And remembering that when I interrogate a prisoner, I'm likely to never see the prisoner again. And I often say to people that when I'm shouting, and you've seen that, everyone's seen it on TV, all the shouting, the shouting is not about the interrogation technique. The technique is a psychological ploy beneath things that play on emotions, things that play on a person's natural drives. The piece that is important is the underpinning. The shouting is to get the person escalated. All of the other stuff underneath, if all you're doing is shouting, you're not accomplishing anything. You're simply ramping a person up, and they're going to respond.
Right. Right, and sometimes there is a benefit to that. And we have it also in dealing with someone who we feel is about to burst, and we don't allow many of our people to do that, but there are situations in which we will go ahead and ramp them up so that they will go ahead and have a verbal or emotional explosion, because then by the time we get them to wherever we're taking them, they've now calmed down and they're more in a therapeutic rapport. You know, because,
well, that's exactly the idea. Is once you get them to the point they explode, now they're out of control of... Typically what you're doing is pushing them into limbic thought. They're starting to respond, and they're, quite frankly, you can manipulate people very easily when they're in that situation. The problem with us as parents and our children is we have a tendency to escalate with them. We get into a ritual of escalation so that when the person does something, they're pushing my buttons at the same time I'm pushing theirs. If an interrogator did that, they would end up in jail because of the response, the natural human response to that kind of escalation. So interrogators have to learn to be calm and quiet while they're shouting. Your mind is calm while your body is shouting. And I often say we're anxiety brokers, and what you're just talking about is brokering anxiety.
Well, Greg, I got to tell you, I am really glad that we were able to get you. I cannot believe that the time has just flown by. We are just about out of time. Again, if you can tell them a little bit, if they're looking to get the book, is this? I believe it's you can get it at Amazon, Barnes and Noble.
Yeah, all of the major distributors will have it, including some of the smallers. And this latest book, The Body Language Handbook, is a photo-based book primarily so that people could apply it in their daily life. Don't expect magic. Don't expect me to tell you this means that. Expect me to give you some tools for you to learn to use so that you'll have a different skill set than even I do.
Absolutely. Again, Greg, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right. Take care. Bye now.
Thanks.
Listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.